Money Jungle. Charlie Mingus, Max Roach, recorded this day in 1962. And they understood that, the prophetic, poetic piece behind Money Jungle and the world we live in today. So we are now joined by three young people from our community. They're not that young. Some of them are getting kind of old, but they're sort of young. And but they're all young to me. Anyway, Megan Sherman is with us, who is a producer at the Real News Network and one of the leaders for me of the Algebra Project, is in the studio with us. Dave Von Love, Director of Research and Public Policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. And Zeke Berzov-Cohen, Executive Director of The Intersection. Good to have the three of you with us in the studio.
Thanks, man.
Good to be here.
And folks, join us here, 410-319-8888. What would you do if you were mayor of Baltimore? Talk at steinershow.org. Write to us. What would you do if you were mayor of Baltimore? Tweet me at Mark Steiner. Log on to our Facebook pages. What would you do to the city to make it different? How could we? Can we make it different? Is it impossible to make it different? Is it impossible? Megan?
Sometimes I think so, but, you know, probably not.
Come on, guys, just jump in.
Sure.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that I think is a great detriment to the city is the way that economic development happens in the city. You know, if you think about the way the paradigm of development in Baltimore, in many ways, good development is characterized in this city by creating, you know, plots of land, industry, in such a way that displaces particularly the black, you know, and low-income residents in the city. And one of the problems is because of the nature of racism and white supremacy, you know, oftentimes, you know, groups, you know, communities that are predominantly black are seen as, you know, detriments to the community. And so oftentimes when development happens, it happens from the vantage point of seeing the folks in those communities as merely pathological, instead of investing in the kinds of institutions that would help those communities build the kind of capacity necessary to be assets to the community and mutually benefit everybody in society. So because of what to many people seems like an impossibility of certain groups of people being able to be productive in our society, development happens in such a way where those folks are merely invisible. That the way the development happens is that if those folks, you know, black people in low-income communities are invisible and unimportant, or able to be deemed as such, then it helps proliferate the nature of the development in our city. And there's a mythology around how economic development happens. You know, the traditional argument is, you know, you bring in big business, it broadens the tax base, and it gives jobs. And what we find is that empirically that isn't true, right? Empirically, all the jobs that are often promised by bringing in big business and big retail is more beneficial to the big corporate interests that come into the city, get big tax breaks, and don't necessarily give jobs to the local residents. And that's why, you know, if you see the city government under the leadership of Jack Young a few months ago, was really, you know, big in trying to get local hiring, which is a difficult thing to, you know, to establish in local municipalities because a lot of the legal ramifications. But generally, the point I'm making is that I think the notion of economic development and changing the paradigm so it sees the people in the communities as the having the capability of being productive and contributing to our society instead of just being merely objects of large corporate interests, I think is something that has to change and something that I would change if I was mayor.
Maybe. One day. Zeke?
Take up that same question from a slightly different angle. I think that we need much greater equity in terms of our development. I think about the major deal that went down about a year ago for Harbor Point, which is pretty close to where I live in southeast Baltimore, where the developer there was able to get $107 million in a TIF and a whole bunch of other tax financing and subsidies. And I wonder about a city that has, that gives its best property. I mean, we're talking premier waterfront property that gives it away and that demands nothing around, like Davon mentioned, local hiring, affordable housing, right? We were supposed to have an inclusionary zoning law where developers were supposed to contribute, I think it was 20% toward market rate affordable housing when they did major deals. And what's unfortunately happened is that we've watered that law down so much that it's now the city that ends up having to pay for affordable housing. And the case is that we don't have that money. And so they just get a waiver and it's like the law never existed. And so I think when we're dealing with major developers, when we're thinking about our premier property like Harbor East, like Harbor Point, we need to start advocating for our citizens, for our city. And I think development is great. I think building, you know, the Whole Foods and everything else is fine. But if you're going to do that, pay your taxes, hire our people, and put some money toward affordable housing. And that's where I think we need to start advocating as a city.
Want to jump back in?
Sure. I mean, I think it depends also on the type of development that you're talking about. I think a lot of times when we think about developing cities, we think about financial development and thinking about housing and businesses. But I also think that in some ways, there are softer things that need to be developed in our communities. So I think like the spirits and the hearts and the minds of the people who live in these communities really need to be developed and honed in on. So I think like programs and educational opportunities for people are really important because they can't, take hold of those economic opportunities if people don't teach them, you know, the things that they need to do to, you know, utilize them in a proper way. So.
And can I add to that just really quickly? Because one of the things when you think about many of the populations that are seen as most vulnerable, many times the approach to those communities is like a social service attitude. So it's like we need to provide services to help these people. Instead of realizing that a lot of these communities, when you think about development, you're developing the people's capacity to benefit from the economic environment that they're in. And I think what we find is that development doesn't happen from the vantage point of helping the people develop the capacity to engage in the economic marketplace in a way that's beneficial to the community, but are forced to conform to whatever market forces are available, not it being seen as it being possible for them to chart their own economic trajectory. And so a part of what needs to happen is the development. Because, you know, if you think about a lot of communities that are already involved in development, they're attached to families and have relationships that can provide them the capital to be able to make their ideas happen. But there's so many people in our communities that have so many ideas, but they don't have the relationships or the capital to make them happen in ways that would help them be able to chart the economic trajectory. So many of us oftentimes are beholden to other folks who have the resources, and we have to capitulate to many of the corporate powers that have the levers of power instead of being able to do it on our own accord.
So you've raised a lot of issues here. And let me read, and folks, please join us here, 410-319-8888. And I want you to join someone who jumps on Facebook. Tyrone wrote on Facebook just now, too many things in need of overhaul by city government. Definitely need to work on the taxes in Baltimore because we're grossly overtaxed. Definitely need to have a way to have jobs in the city, jobs that are not just service-oriented, because we have too many people who are credentialed and aren't being used and dying because they are losing. I know I'm an MBA who can't find work in any of my fields at all. I think that is a reality. So the question is, though, let's tackle this a moment, folks. And I want to know what you think at 410-319-8888. What would you do? What would you do, let's say, with the North Avenue stretch right now? The people are arguing about what happens on North Avenue between Pennsylvania Avenue and Greenmount Avenue and down to, let's say, Mount Royal and up towards Hopkins University. What would you do with that area? What would you do to make it different than what the plans may be right now for that area? We're calling it the Station North Arts, but what would you do with it? 410-319-8888. I mean, it seems to me that this question of development is always one that kind of people wrestle with. I was thinking about one of the things you said first, Zeke, about the inclusionary zoning, where developers are supposed to spend X amount, 12%, whatever that number is, of the money on affordable housing and things to develop. But the trick bag to that law is that the city has to come up with the money.
Right.
People always think, oh, that means that they're going to do it. No, it's the way the law was written. It makes it very easy for companies not to abide by that because and they don't. I mean, so there's things like that.
And the mechanics of city government is that if you really understand the process, a lot of times they get waivers. You know, they have the kind of relationships where they get waivers on those requirements, you know, and so they're able to say in public, of course, you know, there's an inclusionary housing requirement, but if we go down to brass tacks and you see what happens, they get waivers.
Always get waivers.
And, you know, the other piece, just to go back to the Harbor Point thing, because that's fresh on my mind, the other piece that was so egregious to me about that deal was that the developers were able to include within their enterprise map Perkins Homes, the housing project, sort of right by Little Italy, in order to get an enterprise tax credit. Nothing is being done for Perkins Homes. In fact, I would guess that within 10, 15 years, Perkins Homes will no longer be there because that's very desirable property in between Falls Point and Harbor East and everything else. So, you know, again, I think development is good, but we need an expectation for developers that when you come to our city, to the greatest city on earth, to the city of Baltimore, you're expected to give back and you're expected to contribute and pay your taxes and lift up those around you.
410-319-8888, your thoughts on what the city should do and how it could be better and what you would do if you were mayor and what you would do if one of these three people in my studio were mayor. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We want to hear your thoughts. Join folks on Facebook, tweeting us, 410-319-8888. Going back, you know, this whole idea of development, let's just stick with that just for a second. I mean, we do need jobs in the city. When people talk about youth, jobs for youth and all this stuff going on, but if the parents don't have jobs, if fathers and mothers don't have work, then kids, young people can have all the work they need, but it's not going to stabilize a community. So, I mean, that seems to be part of the issue. When the Stadium Authority has this, what is it, I'm trying to get the exact in my head. It was $2.5 billion to rebuild schools in Baltimore that the state legislature voted on. There's nothing in that that says the people who get those jobs have to be from the city of Baltimore. When we had that conversation here, we had loads of people calling in the show that day, electricians, carpenters, plumbers who are African-American living in the city, not having the work that they need to say, hire us, give us the jobs. Or even if you're a laborer, give us the jobs. I mean, that to me is at the heart of this. If big business is going to get money to come in and build something, they need to hire the people of Baltimore to do the work.
Absolutely. I mean, that goes back to the fact that I think a lot of folks in our community are just seen as pathological. Like, people don't think that those kinds of folks are in our communities that could have the capacity to operate big-scale operations like rebuilding our schools. Another thing in terms of, you know, things that need to change, you know, in Baltimore is that, you know, what you'll find is and this is true in any other industry, but you have, you know, many people's, you know, jobs, careers that are dependent on people's relationships that they have with folks. And one of the things that's frustrating, while that's a natural phenomenon in a lot of different industries, oftentimes industries was problematic is that those of us who are of and from the communities most directly affected are often excluded from those networks that have tremendous amounts of influence. And so what you'll find is you have people external to our communities making decisions about our communities, about what gets built up, about development projects, about education. And there needs to be a much bigger emphasis in trusting in the fact that there are people in our own communities that have the wherewithal to determine the trajectory of our community.
Very quickly, let me just point out, Nina just tweeted in, I would require all city employees to live in the city. We'll tackle that one in a moment. And she tweeted, I would require police to walk the beats, showing them, allowing them to get to know their communities. Mike tweeted in, start writing tickets for blocking the box downtown. What does that mean?
No idea.
Blocking the box? I'm just checking. I thought folks across the glass would know what that was. Maybe I don't know. Oh, when you block an intersection,
yeah,
maybe
when you
that
drive through the median
and that annoys me too. That really annoys me. But I mean, so people always have made this argument about people should live in the city if they're going to work here. But I mean, then if the counties did that around us, that would block a lot of city people from getting jobs in the counties.
Well, I don't know about that per se. I think that's an interesting concept, though. I definitely think that police who police these communities need to live here for sure. Like, that to me, I don't understand how, what is it? It was 40 or 50% of the police officers in Baltimore City don't live here. So I don't understand how you can properly police a community if you are not, you know, from there talking to people in there in good times and bad times. But one concept that came up when I was younger, when we were doing some organizing work, was creating a toll for people who come in and out of the city to do work. And so, like, taxing the folks who really benefit from the communities that most people in the city don't. And then taking those resources out into the counties when, you know, they leave. So I think that might be an interesting thing.
Yeah, and I know New York does something like that. I think to the question of jobs, this is where, as a city government, we could look at some really smart development. Right. So instead of just showering largesse and tax breaks on our wealthiest developers with no expectations, this is where I think we could be really smart in terms of, let's create a tax credit to hire locally. Let's create a tax credit to hire local youth. We know that the unemployment rate in Baltimore is around 10%, but for young people between 16 and 24, that unemployment rate is 42%, so four times the city's average. I think smart development is focusing our resources on the people that are already here and putting them to work.
I mean, I think that, I mean, well, there's a study that was done, and I think goes right to the heart of it. And I have a question for the three of you that just came in. There was Carl Alexander was on the show. He was from Johns Hopkins University, who wrote this piece called "The Long Shadow: Family Background, Disadvantage, Urban Youth, and Their Transition to Adulthood." And he did a 30-year study of watching 800 children for 30 years in this community, black and white, upper middle class, poor, working class people, kids in the city. And one of the things he found, which is really interesting, so this has to do with jobs and how the network of jobs works, is that the population of white and black kids he followed who were high school graduates but did not go to college, that I think it was 60% of the white kids had jobs, mm-hmm. only like 30% of the black kids had jobs. I don't have the numbers exactly right, mm-hmm. but it's in that range. Mm-hmm. And so that says a lot about the connections people have in the craft industries and how people get hired, who gets hired as a carpenter, who gets hired as a plumber, who gets hired as an electrician or mechanic, an auto mechanic, and how that works. And I think that to me was very glaring, because there are a lot of people, I mean, we have this idea in our heads, I think, some people do, and I argue this all the time, and people push back on me about it, which is that every person doesn't have to go to college. Doesn't mean every person isn't brilliant and bright and can be an artist and play guitar and be a mathematical genius and doesn't want to go to college. They want to do something else, work with their hands. But it's getting the jobs.
Mm-hmm. And a part of that study was, I remember that the white folks who had jobs after high school, the reason why they had those jobs is because they had relationships with people who were in those industries. So right. It was a lot easier for them because they had right. uncles and cousins who could get them jobs. But for the black folks who were trying to get into those industries, it was much more difficult because they didn't have those relationships.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's something that we can, I think if we know that's the case, it seems to be a behoove the elected leaders to really wrestle with how you resolve that.
Right, right. Right? And, I mean, and going to this issue of relationships.
Not that it's easy, but how you resolve it.
Exactly. I think apart just, you know, on the issue of relationships, I mean, I think one of the things we have to realize is that, you know, elected officials, a lot of their disposition in the world is to curry favor. And one of the things that people say to me a lot is, well, Davon, we have, you know, a black mayor and black elected officials. You know, why, you know, how could you have, you know, or make this argument that we're talking about institutional racism if you have black folks in leadership? And I think one of the things that you'll find, and a lot of folks I don't think are comfortable talking about this in public, but the fact that in a society structured on racism and white supremacy, you have a lot of, you know, black folks that are, you know, that are currying favor, particularly from, you know, white developers, from white corporate interests, who are enthralled, who are happy, excited that, you know, these folks like them and will give them money and will give them support. I think in ways that oftentimes cause many of our elected officials to curry the favor of those folks instead of currying the favor of the people of and from our communities.
We have to take a short break and I'll come right back. I have a question for all of you about these ideas you just raised from somebody who just wrote in, 410-319-8888. Find rather tweet and write than call. I'm cool with that, but call if you can, 410-319-8888. We'll be right back. Stay with us as we discuss what would you do if you were mayor of Baltimore. Mon rêve, from the Martinique, the band from Martinique, Malvois, came out in 1968. Great place, Martinique. We could all be there right now on the beach, but we're not. We're here in Mark Steiner Show. So join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. We're here with Megan Sherman, Davon Love, and Zeke Berzov Cohen. What would you do if you were mayor of Baltimore? 410-319-8888. So let me read this. This came in. All these ideas sound good, but how do you actually do that? The mayor is always talking about how tight the budget is. How would we make it happen? What would we cut?
So again, to me, when I look at $107 million in a TIF for the largest developers to develop the largest the most profitable plot of land left in our city, that's where I would start, right, is the very high-end tax breaks that we are giving to our wealthiest developers. I would spread that money out. I would develop underserved neighborhoods. I would really think about what does the Perkins Homes need if they're going to be part of someone's enterprise map. And I would go from there. I think, you know, our city is not poor. We need to get out from under that illusion. Yes, we do have concentrated poverty in different parts of Baltimore, but we also have T. Rowe and we have banks and we have major financial institutions and we have some of the best colleges and medical institutions in the world. We have the resources to be a great world-class city. So I think we need to stop living this mindset of the city is broke, because we're not.
Yeah, I mean, I always tell this story about I was at a hearing in City Hall, and you know, if you think about like the bond rating that the city has, a lot of it's dependent on financial institutions' designation of a particular municipality's expenditures as being profitable. And I remember being at a hearing and saying that, you know, they asked about all the money that it cost to clear up the snow. And that was fine with a particular financial agency, but they cut crossing guards because for them that was an acceptable expense, you know, in terms of designating the
to clean the snow. We cut crossing guards. Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, not they were going over different expenses.
Oh, I see. I got you. I
right,
got you. Okay,
seeing
right.
which ones were okay, which right, ones right, weren't. Right, and right. apparently that one was an okay expense, you know, and so they were willing to go into the rainy day fund, which is a part of how we, you know, fortify the bond rating. But they had to, they cut crossing guards. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, just if you step back and just think about what that sounds like, it sounds like there's money there, but only certain expenditures are seen as acceptable expenditures. And so a part of it is really having a vision of economic development that at its core, you know, is interested in developing the community. Because I think one of the things that happens is I think we separate out economic, social, and human capital in ways that I think created. So when we think about development, we think just of the buildings, we think just of the economic capital. But if you think about developing the community's potential to have its own capacity, you're developing social and human capital in ways that benefit everyone, right? You're creating opportunities for economic development when you develop some social and human capital. The problem is many of those who are doing the development don't see any potential in the communities that they're trying to develop. They just see pathology. And so they want to invest in developing the human and social capital in those communities to build up their own infrastructure. Because that would mutually benefit everyone, and a lot of people don't see that vision, again, because most of our understandings of development is just the buildings and just the place and not the people.
Enough what you're saying here. We'll go to the phones here and read this email that came in as well, 410-319-8888 and talk@steinershow.org, is that this is really another critical piece, I think, that has to be fleshed out in our city for the leaders to grapple with and those who will become leaders to grapple with, which is how you develop with the people in the communities who live there now and not think of them as extraneous to be pushed out, exactly. Had their homes bought out, and moved away.
Exactly.
I mean that's what you're saying, exactly. In a nutshell, right? And
exactly.
So, I mean, that is a big piece of this. You know, I was driving down North Avenue, and I think about the creative resources we have in this town, like the School of Architecture and Design here at Morgan State University, or the Architecture and Design Program at MICA. And the brilliant kind of creative minds that are Black, white, Asian, Latino, who are all in these schools, that think all the time about how you redevelop a community to make it a place for people to live in. The city should be investing in those organizations that come from this community to help communities figure out and work with them to figure out what they want their communities to be. How does that tie into the development they want to come in? Driving North Avenue, I saw these, you know, I knew as a kid North Avenue, every one of those homes had people in them and families, and the place was vibrant. People were walking around all the time. Pennsylvania Avenue was happening. It was jumping all day, night, and long, you know. And so you look at that place now, there's gaping holes, but that could be fixed with creative thinking. That could be done by the people in there, and vacant lots could become gardens and places for people to live and have communal places. But we don't think that way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
We don't think that way.
I mean, I'm from Howard Park. I grew up in Howard Park. It's a, you know, very middle-class community, very elderly community. making the proper investments, that would be a vibrant community. You know, it would be a world-class neighborhood. It has the potential to be
a world-class neighborhood. Look at the houses in Howard Park, Forest Park.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, Windsor Hills.
Mansions.
Or look at the ShopRite that moved in there, yeah. And all of a sudden, right. Everyone's...
And it's a shame. It took 10 years to get a grocery store in that area. You know, and to me, the only way you explain the lack of development of a community like that, like of investment, is racism.
A black middle-class community.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's the only way you explain not developing that community.
And if you really think about it, if you talk about budgets, like, it's really a testament to what our values are. And I think that's kind of what it really goes down to. Like, if we're not talking about what we as communities value as far as people goes and as far as resources goes for those communities, like you talking about Howard Park, like a perfect example of a place where it's no reason not to invest in those people. They already are homeowners, probably. They already have invested in their own futures in their own neighborhoods. And so I don't see a reason why, you know what I'm saying, you wouldn't do that for any other reason other than racism or, you know, white supremacy.
I'm going to go to the phones here and these tweets coming in, people calling in and also tweeting in. Somebody wrote an email, try to get to all those in the time we have left here. The one thing Bob Embry said to me that when he always argued this point, that he said Baltimore has lots of housing stock. And he was thinking about the Forest Parks and Howard Parks, but we don't think of those neighborhoods as places to move to because why?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
410-319. And they're great houses. I mean, I lived in Windsor Hills for 27 years, you know, on the west side of town. The beautiful homes, interracial neighborhood, mostly black, but interracial neighborhood. It was just a beautiful place to live. People don't realize we have these neighborhoods in our city. 410-319-8888. Melissa tweets in, also need assessments. Do we even know what services are on offer now? Do we know how many get served, where the gaps exist? And she tweeted in, audits of everything. Must know what is coming in and going out before we can discuss cuts and priorities. An audit of and that's something we've argued in the show before that people have been talking about. 410-319-8888. Phil, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Phil, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Hey, yes. I think what we really need is a work project administration in Baltimore City, hiring the unemployed, hiring kids in the summer to work throughout the city, making a 1,000-man strong, paying them $15 or so an hour, and really, you know, bringing the city back to life, putting making a major push for whiting the roofs of all the housing in the city to reflect the sun and putting solar panels on top of houses and stuff like that, make this place, you know, a wonderful place to live instead of, you know, somewhere that's dangerous just to walk out the door in some neighborhoods, not all neighborhoods, but some. And I think those, you know, if you pay people a decent wage, you know, all that money will stay within the city, and it'll circulate, and people will be happy, and there won't be any crime because people will be too busy to engage in crime.
Phil, I think Phil has a strong point.
Yeah, I mean, I think just generally we need to shift our framework and stop looking at a major part of our population as expendable. In terms of how we're investing in prisons instead of schools and other resources. And so I think about a young woman in my program who came up through the foster system, who had a very difficult time, got in a lot of trouble early on in life, and came very close to dropping out of school and was sort of pegged as a bad kid that would end up in prison. Fortunately, what ended up happening is that she found our program and she got engaged with a bunch of really good adults like Davon, like Mark, and like a bunch of others. And now that young woman is the president of the Maryland Youth Advisory Commission, and she advises the governor on youth-related policies. And in about a month, she'll be joining me in India to speak at a major conference there. And that's what's possible for every child in Baltimore City and every adult if we invest in our people.
And I think people don't get that because they don't see it. They only see certain glitzy programs, whether it's the Intersection or the Algebra Project or Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, have touched the minds and the hearts of thousands of young people in the city and have given people a chance to say, there's a different way to live my life. I can grab a hold of something. And we don't pay attention to that either, or what that can mean. You know, and Nina, we'll go back to the phones here. Nina retweeted to respond to the last tweet that just came in about audits. Nina tweeted in, but rather than pay for audits, interesting idea here, have local grad schools do it as training.
maybe.
We have the MBAs
yeah.
who are studying statistics. Let them do the grunt work of going in to do the audits, supervised by their professors who know how to do the audits. You know, graduate students at Morgan, graduate students at Baltimore, graduate students at Towson, have them come in and do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, I wouldn't throw that idea out.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, saves the city money. Students get to learn how to do it, and we see what's happening inside of our city government.
And I do think there's a lot more we can do to invest our local colleges here into what's going on in Baltimore, mm-hmm. whether it's Morgan, whether it's Coppin, whether it's Loyola, whether it's Hopkins. You know, I think there's much more we can do to keep the talent that we're creating at these different institutions in the city and engage them in the processes that we've got going on to make Baltimore a better place.
Let's jump into one more call here, several more calls, 410-319-8888. Gregory, you're on the air.
Good morning to your guest.
Good morning, Gregory.
If I was mayor, I would definitely take some of the money that comes from the casinos and the lottery and build or refurbish four of the vacant high school buildings and turn them back into vocational and trade schools. I would also work with businesses or with the city council to have a citywide recycling enterprise, paying citizens a stipend for recyclable materials on a biweekly basis. It would promote keeping neighborhoods clean, and it would also create jobs for people because a large recycling plant can be opened where those goods are going to, and also maybe a textile plant. So many garments are made overseas. Say, for instance, Nike. They charge $100-some for tennis shoes, but they're probably manufactured over in China somewhere for $10-$15 a pair. I mean, that's most of that is profit for them.
We might want to start with the one that's in Baltimore, mm-hmm. Under Armour.
Yeah, and Under Armour has shown that building a major corporation in Baltimore is very much possible, right? I mean, again, to this myth we have that if you come to Baltimore, you're not going to be profitable, that you should move to Texas, that you should, you know, that the taxes are going to kill you. You know, I would talk to the CEO of Under Armour, who has done extremely well in Baltimore. You know, that's what's possible. There should be more stories like Under Armour here.
Yeah, that's before we go back to the phones at 410-319-8888. What would you do if you were mayor of Baltimore? Patrick, you're on the air. Hi, Patrick, you're on the air.
Look, if I was mayor of Baltimore, I would do what they done in the South Bronx 25 years ago. 25 years ago in the South Bronx in New York City, all those abandoned buildings, they start a massive apprentice program. And every developer who was buying these buildings from the city, they was training a lot of apprentices to be carpenters. And then after they become carpenters, then they put them into the union. Baltimore have 60,000 vacant buildings sitting around there. I moved here 10 years now from up north. My taxes keep going up. I can't walk around the block before some young lady not approaching me, ask me if I want to get a job. And these things is not right. So if I was mayor, that's the first thing I would do. Start a massive apprentice program, because I'm in the construction, Mark. And another thing I recognize since I moved here, most of the different groups, the Spanish, the whites, the Indians, the Koreans, they all have their own organization in construction. So they keep squeezing us as black folks. They squeezing us out because they can take a job for $60,000 or $90,000. And 15 of them can work on the job, and then they would divide the money among themselves. Because we blacks don't have no unity among ourselves, we stay out of work constantly. So there was a big, big, big problem here in Baltimore. And that's my comment this morning.
Patrick, good to hear from you. Let's see what Patrick said. I mean, I agree and disagree with what he said, but anybody wants to jump in first, they can.
I mean, I think he makes a very good point. I think, you know, people generally are afraid to talk about, you know, racism and white supremacy, are afraid to talk about the importance of independent black institutions. And I think it's important. I think it's important that in Baltimore, we develop the sense of race literacy, like literacy on issues of race, in order to understand why you need independent black institutions that represent the interests of black folks specifically, not as some isolated group that is detached from the rest of the world, but as a institution that, as its at its core, its mission is to look out and protect the interests of black folks. And I think, you know, this city, in many on many levels of leadership, folks are just afraid to even say that because a lot of people don't even have the literacy of understanding race to know why that's important.
Definitely. I completely agree. I mean, we have plenty of Jewish organizations in the city, plenty of, what is there, a Korean association for business owners that's, like, not far from here in the county. I don't see why, you know, an organization specifically dedicated to employing black people and training black people to develop their own communities is an option.
I mean, I think that, well, there are two things there. Let me just throw something, a little pushback, just to come for the conversation. I mean, I think that, I mean, there are black business organizations in this town that are specifically there for to build black, small black businesses and to push the city to hire black construction firms, and those things have been in existence for a while. I don't know of any Jewish organizations in town that are business-oriented that are there only to hire Jews. I really don't. You hear that myth, but I don't know of one.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think
there are Jewish communal organizations that take care of the Jewish community communally,
right?
You know, but that's different than having a business saying, I'm only going to hire a Jew, I'm only going to hire, you know. And a lot of immigrants do band together when they come in town to pool their money to take care of families, and that does happen. And that's what used to happen in the black community too. From between the 20s and the 60s, people coming up from the South, people did do that. They band together, pooled their money, started businesses, you know, worked collectively. That did happen, and has to happen again.
Right. And see, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, it's not, because we're not saying that there should be, you know, again, this isolated group that only cares about that group. It's just to say that there should be a group that is dedicated to making sure that, you know, people of African descent have those opportunities for ourselves, just as other communities do so in other sectors and other fields of life. And I think that's completely reasonable.
Okay, because that's one way that also, besides building that up in the black community, that's also filters out to say there's a different world that can be built.
Right, right. And it benefits everybody.
Exactly.
That's the thing that I think people miss. It's you know, empowering black folks of independent black institutions benefits everyone. You're developing the human, social, economic capital that everyone is going to benefit from.
Amen.
I mean, the only thing I would add to that is that I would say that the Jewish community is not monolithic, that it is, there are schisms left and right, that there's schism within sort of the Orthodox community in Park Heights. There's schisms within the Reform and, you know, sort of more progressive communities. I mean, I think, you know, sometimes when we have these conversations, it's like the Jewish community looks out for the Jewish community. But if you kind of dig a little bit deeper, there is a lot of complication within the Jewish community and within most communities. You know, just to
every,
put that
every
out
community
there.
Is like
right,
that.
Right. And I think that's true. I think one thing that's important to keep in mind is that I think it's about the possibility to the discourse allows for. So I think in our society, the political discourse is such that the notion of independent black institutions freaks people out on a variety of policy levels in a way that it doesn't for other folks. And I think that's important, because it's important to understand the complexities within those communities and differences while understanding the importance of having institutions that address their specific needs.
People didn't understand Garvey. They didn't understand Delaney for all those same reasons
in
the history of the United States of America.
Exactly.
Let me get this email in here and try to get another the email real fast and read this, and then also get to another caller. Brenda, when it comes to your call here. But let me read part of this. He said, this was coming in from James on email, talkatsteinershow.org. What I would do differently would be to recognize that a big part of the problems that we, nearly all the governments and state governments face, are the cuts from federal spending that state and local governments spending depends on. That's widely acknowledged, but elected officials come up short about what to do about it. And here's what I would do. We know where the money is. We see the evidence of this each and every day. I would organize my constituents to accompany me and my leaders to be transported to Washington to demand the U.S. Congress restore funding to the needs of people where we live and work. Sending troops and equipment to Liberia to help contain Ebola and treat the victims is worthy and noble humanitarian imperative. Sending piloted planes, weapons, and guns and advisors to war-torn Middle East, thereby helping to ensure the war remains war-torn, deadly and threatening, is neither worthy nor noble. Federal spending is too much on destruction, whereas we need domestic spending right here in River City, Balmer City. Restore, as he wrote it, restore funding for job creation, restore funding for infrastructure, no cuts to social needs like Social Security, SSA funding, Medicare, Medicaid. I think part of the answer, too, is what he's saying is a political mobilization to build a political organization in this town demanding that we have to have a different America. Mm-hmm. Now, Mayor Baltimore can't do it alone.
Mm-hmm. Cut defense spending, you know, I mean, that to me is something that's an easy, that's a very easy thing that I think most people can agree on. We spend way too much on the military.
Yeah, it's critical. And there's investments that could be made. So we know that James Heckman says that for every dollar we invested in early childhood, it would pay off somewhere between $7 and $16 down the road. So it's not like a zero-sum game. If we invest in education, if we invest in job creation and institutions that are creating jobs, it'll have a payoff and the tax base here will grow.
Let me get another call in here, 410-319-8888 in the time we have left. Brenda, you're on the air. Welcome. Hi, Brenda. Welcome. You're on the air. Brenda? We have Brenda? If your radio's on, turn it down, then we can hear you. There you are.
Oh, my fine. I'm sorry. Yes, I'm here.
That's okay. There you are. Go ahead.
If I was mayor, I came here from another city, and I stayed on North Avenue by Pennsylvania. The first thing that caught my eye, the first thought in my head, was that they were going to have bubonic plague in this town eventually because of the number of rats. I came from two major cities, and I've seen rats there, but not just in the daytime, but random everywhere in the city. You had sections where they would be, mostly by the water, or where there was a group of restaurants in New York. Baltimore rats are everywhere, and it's not only disgusting, it's dangerous. Number one, if I was mayor, I don't understand why she did this anyway. I would restore the garbage pickup to twice a week, give those men back their jobs, and I would institute a program of really enforcing loitering laws so that we don't feed these rats in Baltimore. Number two, a visitor notices is all these abandoned buildings and all these homeless and jobless men. It's not rocket science. It is not rocket science. Why would you outsource development of these communities to other people who have no interest except money and displacement when you have all these homeless and jobless men right here that not only need a job, they need a place to live, they need to stand up as a man and feel as a man. They would, like the man said before, they wouldn't be prone to drugs and alcohol and all these self-destructive behaviors because they'll feel like what they're supposed to feel within themselves. There should be some kind of agreement between the homeless men, jobless men, and the building up and the rehabilitation of all these vacant properties in this city. And I understand people have concerns about people having false claims, I broke my back and blah, blah, blah. You indemnify these people so that you are not responsible if they have these accidents. And you partner with Home Depot and other home places to dedicate and give services and get them incentives to do so, to help these people rehab Baltimore. If you have men that work here, live here, homeless, jobless, and rehab, they're not going to tear down that house. Neither are they going to let anyone else tear down because they are vested in it. Why your mayor doesn't see this and why she stopped that garbage pickup is a disgrace.
Thank you, Brent. I'm glad we had a chance to I think you hit some really important points. Yeah, it actually used to be a rat patrol in the city that they defunded as well, where people actually hire community people to deal with deal with rats in communities and help annihilate them, and also help people kind of figure out how to build their houses and their homes so they don't attract rats. But we ended that program, along with lots of other programs in this town that you said have. Closing thoughts from our guests. We have about 3 minutes left. Let's start with Megan Sherman.
I think that the points that have been made today basically outline that we really need to invest in the people of our communities and not in just thinking about money and thinking about how to build up institutions that do not benefit those communities. And so, you know, I think educationally we need to do that. I think socially and spiritually we really need to, like, you know, put more money and more effort and more time into developing the people in the city. And I think we'll get a lot back from it.
Davon Love.
The notion of black inferiority runs really deep in the city and really around the country. And what happens is that our government and many of the major institutions in our city operate from this vantage point. I think if we're going to see a city that'll be better, we have to operate in a way where we see value, we see possibility in the very people that we've been socialized to see as inferior. And until we do that, and until we get to a place where we understand that we can, on the basis of our own strengths and talents, can be able to lift this city up from the condition that it's in, then we're going to perpetually be in a situation where we're dependent on folks external to our communities to uplift us. And freedom is not something that's given to you, something you got to take.
So I would agree with Brenda that there's a real economic self-interest in putting men back to work in our communities. And I used to teach around where she lives in Sandtown. So if we continue to have this large population of folks that's unemployed, ultimately they'll find their way into the criminal justice system, and we'll be paying for it through taxes, through incarceration. And I think that's a really bad way to run a city. I think it makes a lot of sense to invest in local talent. And also, the one thing we didn't touch on was our schools. I think the community school model makes a lot of sense for a place like Baltimore City. I think an investment in early childhood is critical. I think we should all be ashamed that of the kids that go to college in this town, only 15% of them are graduating on time. And we have schools like Liberty Elementary School that are showing that it's possible to educate all of our kids in a great and productive way.
Where I went to elementary school.
Is that right?
Yeah. But let me thank the three of you. There was Zeke Berzov-Cohen, Executive Director of The Intersection, Dave Von Love, Director of Research and Public Policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, Megan Sherman, producer of the Real News Network, who came out of the Algebra Project.
Oh, New Lens Production.
New Lens Production. Another great program in our town. And we're going to continue this conversation. If I were mayor, what would I do? It generated a lot of calls and tweets and emails, and we'll be bringing the three of these people on, among and others as well, to continue this discussion over the next years about what we would do to try to build something in this town, to think about creatively and practically what we can do to change the city of Baltimore and to help build this new leadership that I hope one day will get elected to city council and the mayor's office and actually take the reins of power and make the change. Good to have the three of you with us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Marvin McDowell and others. He's founder and president of Umar Boxing, and talking about boxing and books, two of my favorite subjects. We'll be right back. Don't go away.